Welcome. We're doing a deep dive today, zeroing in on the COEN SAPAR Leadership Refresher Training, specifically Module 3, Sexual Harassment.
That's right. And our mission here is really to reinforce the critical knowledge and skills you as leaders need to effectively prevent and respond.
It's more than just policy, isn't it? There's a really critical connection we need to establish right up front.
Absolutely. The why behind aggressive leadership action here is vital. We have to talk about sexual harassment because, well, statistically, it can often be an early warning sign, a precursor, really, to potential sexual assault.
So addressing it isn't just about compliance. It's fundamentally about readiness and the safety of our people. Tackling harassment early can prevent that escalation.
Exactly. It's about maintaining unit cohesion and capability. So the source material we're drawing from, the COEN SAPAR Leadership Refresher, TSP, gives us that necessary framework.
Okay, let's start with the fundamentals then, defining the threat itself. What exactly constitutes sexual harassment according to policy?
All right, so the core definition involves conduct like unwelcome sexual advances, requests for sexual favors, and also deliberate or repeated offensive comments or gestures of a sexual nature.
But there are specific conditions where that conduct becomes actual harassment, right?
Yes, there are conditions. It's harassment when submission is either explicitly or implicitly a term or condition of someone's job, their pay, or their career progression.
That sounds like the first type people often think of.
It is. That's quid pro quo, Latin, you know, for this, for that. It's that direct link submission for a job benefit or rejection leading to a negative consequence.
And you mentioned implicit conditions, too. That sounds like it could be subtle.
It can be, but the definition also covers situations where submission or rejection is used as a basis for career decisions affecting that person.
Okay. What else falls under the definition?
The conduct also qualifies if it unreasonably interferes with someone's work performance or if it creates an environment that's intimidating, hostile, or offensive.
And there's a standard for that, isn't there? It's not just subjective.
Correct. The conduct has to be severe or pervasive enough that a reasonable person would perceive the environment as hostile or offensive. And importantly, the victim must also perceive it that way.
Both perspectives matter. The reasonable person and the victim. That's a key point for leaders.
Definitely. Now, that quid pro quo type, we mentioned this for that. It can also impact others, not just the person directly involved.
How so?
Well, think about sexual favoritism. If someone gets preferential treatment because of a sexual relationship, others might feel unfairly disadvantaged. They could then report discrimination. It widens the net.
Okay, so that's quid pro quo. What's the other main type?
The second type is the hostile environment. This is probably more common, or at least reported more often. It happens when soldiers, family members, or DA civilians face offensive, unwanted, and unsolicited comments or behaviors of a sexual nature.
So less of a direct transaction, more about the overall atmosphere.
Exactly. It poisons the work environment. And to help leaders spot this, we break it down into three categories.
Okay, what are those?
First, verbal. Think explicit comments, jokes, suggestive sounds, things overheard.
Second.
Nonverbal. This could be suggestive gestures, leering, displaying offensive materials, things observed.
And the third is obvious, I assume.
Physical contact, unwanted touching, blocking movement, assault, anything physical and unwelcome.
And crucially, leaders need to remember, Army policy applies 24/7. Right.
Right.
On or off the installation.
Absolutely. 24/7. Now, when someone decides to report, what should leaders know? First off, while we encourage complainants to confront the offender if they feel safe doing so.
They're not required to.
Not required at all. That's their choice. And when they do come forward, there are specific formal pathways.
Let's walk through those. What are the options?
Okay. Three main formal options. First, an anonymous complaint. Allows reporting while protecting identity.
It's straightforward enough.
Second, an informal complaint. Here, the complainant wants the issue resolved, but they don't want to file a formal complaint on DA Form 7746.
How is that handled?
It's resolved by a full-time MEO representative. Importantly, this is typically without command involvement being required, though the MEO rep documents it.
And a quick note here, some older pocket cards might mention things like direct approach, or third party for informal reporting, that's outdated now.
That's right. The correct informal path now is through the MEO office. It gets documented with an MFR, locally filed.
Good clarification. And the third option?
The formal complaint. This one is filed in writing using DA form 7746, and once that happens, the commander is notified.
Okay. Now, this next part feels like where things can get complicated fast for leaders, especially in the guard jurisdiction.
This is absolutely critical. Who handles what, and what are the deadlines? It depends entirely on the soldier's or civilian's duty status at the time of the incident. Get this wrong, and you failed that individual.
Let's be precise then. Start with Title 32 National Guard soldiers. So, state duty status.
Okay. For Title 32 soldiers, they must file their sexual harassment complaint with the Military Equal Opportunity Office, the MEO, not the SARC.
MEO, not SARC. Got it. Is there a deadline?
Yes, and it's specific. 180 calendar days from when they became aware of the harassment.
180 days, MEO. And what if a Title 32 soldier mistakenly goes to a SARC or a VA first?
That's a critical action point for SARCs and VAs. If a Title 32 soldier comes to you with an SH complaint, you must redirect them to the MEO office and provide a warm handoff and actively connect them. Don't just point them down the hall.
Okay, warm handoff to MEO for Title 32 within 180 days. How does that compare to Title 10 soldiers, federal duty status?
It's different. Title 10 soldiers file their formal SH complaint either with their commander or with the SARC.
Ah, so the SARC is an appropriate reporting avenue for Title 10.
Yes. And in the Title 10 case, the SARC actually provides the case management and support for the SH complaint, similar to how they handle sexual assault cases.
Big difference depending on the title. What about our DA civilians?
Another distinct pathway. DA civilians file through the Equal Employment Opportunity Office, the EEO.
And their deadline.
Much shorter. They need to initiate contact with the EEO office within 45 calendar days of the incident or becoming aware of it.
Only 45 days, that's tight.
It is. And civilians also have specific rights under federal law, including protection from retaliation for reporting and the right to pursue administrative remedies through EEO, potentially even leading to lawsuits.
Okay, MEO for Title 32 within 180 days, SARC or Commander for Title 10. EEO for DA civilians within 45 days. Leaders absolutely have to nail those distinctions.
Failure is not an option there. It directly impacts the complainant's rights and options.
All right, let's shift from policy to practice. Let's look at some vignettes from the training material to see how this plays out. Vignette 1, Battalion Motor Pool PCC PCIs.
Okay. In this scenario, you have SSG Smith, who brings out a blow-up doll, calls it Molly, during vehicle inspections. Supposedly a joke. SBC Wynn, who is new, is clearly humiliated by vulgar comments related to the doll and feels forced to go along with it. She eventually reports it.
This seems pretty clear-cut. What's the violation?
It's a classic example of creating a hostile work environment. It violates AR 652 and the principles in Title 10 USC 1561. The use of the doll, the comments, it's textbook.
So the analysis is straightforward. But what's the leadership challenge here? What if Molly has been around for years, kind of a twisted unit tradition?
That's exactly the friction point. A junior leader, or any leader, might feel pressure not to rock the boat. But tradition doesn't excuse harassment. The takeaway is immediate intervention.
What could that look like?
Options include correcting it on the spot, if feasible, informing the higher chain of command immediately, talking to the MEO office for guidance, or even using the anonymous complaint option if there's fear of reprisal. But inaction isn't acceptable. Allowing that normalizes objectification.
It directly undermines good order and discipline. Okay, vignette 2. Helicopter flight operations. This one involves senior ranks.
Right. CW2 Hardy, who happens to be a victim advocate, is near a group of male soldiers. Seal Moore, the brigade commander, makes an inappropriate comment about her. LTC Green overhears and warns the colonel quietly.
Okay, an intervention happened, but it doesn't end there.
No. Seal Moore then looks CW2 Hardy up and down, smirks, and says she's not a victim yet.
Wow. That's blatant. Yeah, and threatening.
Extremely. Clear sexual harassment made infinitely worse because it's coming from the brigade commander. It sends a chilling message about the command climate.
So LTC Green tried to intervene subtly. What's the takeaway for leaders like LTC Green when dealing with a superior officer engaging in harassment?
This is about moral courage. LTC Green could attempt a more direct approach, counseling Sheil Moore maybe risky but possible, or the more likely proper channel is to notify Sheil Moore's commander. You have to be prepared to address this regardless of rank.
Ignoring it because it's the boss just enables toxic leadership.
Precisely. Okay, let's look at one more. Vignette 6. A formal sexual harassment complaint is initiated. This deals with what happens after a report.
The aftermath. What's the situation?
SBC Coles files a formal SH complaint about a sexually suggestive hot list circulating in the unit. After she files, things get worse for her. She's ostracized, called names like slut and troublemaker. Peers exclude her, and she finds a threatening note telling her to drop the complaint.
This is retaliation, plain and simple.
Exactly. The ostracism, the name-calling, the threat that's retaliation for engaging in protected activity, which is filing the SH complaint.
And retaliation can be just as damaging, if not more so, than the original harassment. It attacks the reporting system itself.
It absolutely does. Leaders must be vigilant for this. The takeaway is that retaliation is also unacceptable and reportable.
Where can soldiers or civilians report retaliation?
They can report it through their chain of command to a SAPR victim advocate, to the EEO or MEO offices, or even to the Inspector General, the IG. And remember, DA civilians have specific federal protections against retaliation.
Zero tolerance has to apply to retaliation just as much as the initial harassment.
Yeah.
Good. Now let's talk accountability. What happens when individuals, including leaders, fail to comply or are found to have committed harassment or retaliation?
Commanders have a range of tools. On the administrative side, this can include mandatory counseling, administrative separation, potentially ending a career or a bar to reenlistment.
What else?
Adverse performance evaluation, specifically noting non-support of the SAPR program. Relief for cause, reduction in rank, formal admonitions or reprimands, withholding privileges like pass requests, or even a rehabilitative transfer.
So, significant administrative consequences. What about punitive actions under military justice?
Yes. Several UCMJ articles or CCMJ for Guard members not entitled 10 status can apply. Article 92 for violating a general regulation like AR 620. Article 93, cruelty and maltreatment. Article 117, provoking speeches or gestures.
Any others?
Article 130, stalking, could be relevant in some cases. And Article 134, the general article, often covers things like indecent language used in harassment.
And if a complaint involves potential criminal conduct under the UCMJ or CCMJ.
If a commander receives a complaint, like a formal SH complaint, that includes allegations amounting to a potential offense under the UCMJ-BCMJ, it generally needs to be referred appropriately, often involving the IG or military police, depending on the specifics. For SH specifically investigated by MEO, if a related offense is discovered, coordination occurs.
Okay, so there are real teeth behind these policies, both administrative and potentially punitive.
There have to be.
All right, let's wrap this deep dive up. For every leader listening, what are the absolute must-know takeaways from Module 3?
First, understand the definitions quid pro quo and hostile environment. Recognize the categories verbal, nonverbal, physical contact.
And critically.
Critically, master the reporting jurisdictions and timelines. Title 32 means MEO, 180 days, and SARCs must provide a warm handoff to MEO. Title 10 means SARC or commander, and the SARC manages the case. DA civilians mean EEO within 45 days. You have to get that right.
Getting that right is fundamental to supporting the complainant properly. It prevents further harm caused by procedural errors.
Absolutely.
So as we close out, here's a final thought. The training material explicitly calls this foundational to prevention. If we accept the premise, backed by data, that sexual harassment can be a precursor to sexual assault,
which the data strongly suggests,
then the question for you, the leader, isn't just, do I know the rules? But what immediate proactive steps am I taking right now in my unit to actively dismantle any conditions that could foster a hostile environment? How are you preventing the precursor before it even has a chance to escalate and potentially compromise readiness or lead to assault?
That shift from passive knowledge to active daily prevention and intervention, that's the leadership challenge. That's your mission.